Welcome to Asphalt Talk, a podcast by and for asphalt professionals. Join our expert hosts as they tackle real industry issues to pave a smoother way for asphalt suppliers and producers. This podcast is sponsored by MAPA, the Missouri Asphalt Pavement Association. Founded to promote quality and accountability, MAPA has been serving the asphalt producers of Missouri since 1990. And now a public service announcement from our sponsor, MayCreate Design. Google Translate doesn't work for web designer to paving company translations. You say hot mix and it thinks you're talking about the latest snack craze. Wouldn't it be nice to work with a designer who knows the difference between binders and bitumen? Work with folks who have been speaking your language for the past 17 years. Visit maycreate.com. That's M-A-Y-E-create.com. Because if you think your website sucks, so does everyone else.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Asphalt Talk. I'm your host, Dale Williams, with the Missouri Asphalt Pavement Association. Today, we're sitting down with Colonel Mark Tillman, former commander of the Air Force One on 9/11, keynote speaker for the 2025 MAPA Annual Conference. Colonel Tillman, it's an honor to have you with us today. I look forward to our discussion and learn a bit about your incredible experiences and give listeners a taste of what they can expect to hear from you, keynote address at the conference. And you know, as we're recording this on the heels of Veterans Day, first of all, I'd just like to say thank you for your service to the country.
No, thank you so much for saying that. It means a lot coming from everybody to recognize the veterans. I got about 100 texts yesterday from veterans all around the world thanking me and me thanking them. And it's a tight network. And, you know, when the country calls, I guarantee you we're all going to throw that uniform back on and head back. And for me, I know it'll get a new uniform. Mine's a little tight at the moment, but I'll make it happen for sure.
Well, we appreciate your service and all the veterans. We certainly couldn't do the things we can today without folks like yourself.
Thank you.
So with that, can you maybe take us back to September 11th, 2001, and describe what it was like for you on that historic day as commander of Air Force One?
You know, definitely. It was the final day of a two-day trip, education visit to the state of Florida. And it was in kind of unusual terms, it was a simple trip. Fly to Florida, turn around, fly back to Washington, D.C. We had no knowledge of what was about to occur on September 11th. Many people said we should have known it. But we just did not. The terrorist action, the plan was so simple to hijack aircraft. And how they did it was incredibly easy for them to get on board with our security at the time. It's all changed since then, obviously. But, you know, on September 11th, all it was show up at the plane. And everything is all set up. You know, we are highly trained. We're ready to go. 10:30 takeoff to leave Florida, head back to Washington, D.C. We all showed up about 8 to 8:30, hijacking basically the terrorists were moving up and down the East Coast in aircraft, departing out of different airports, starting from 8 o'clock to 8:42. So while we were getting the plane ready, planes were being hijacked. So as I'm stepping on board the aircraft at roughly 8:35 and I'm doing my job, walking from nose to tail, all of a sudden at 8:46 happened, where the first tower, the North Tower, was hit by American Airlines 11. And at that point, you know, I running upstairs, seeing what's happening, it became a kind of a miscommunication amongst everybody. The FAA knew what was going on, but a lot of other agencies didn't. And it was listed as a light aircraft strike on the tower's operator error. And that's how it was briefed to the president as he went to an elementary school. And for us, it was the same thing. But the pictures we kept seeing on the Today Show, that was our only source of television at that time, was tuners on the aircraft. And we didn't have DirecTV access. So, but most of us, the three pilots on board, when you look at the footprint of what hit that tower, it was not a light aircraft. And we kept saying that to each other. But we knew that the president would go visit New York, obvious loss of life. And from then, everything started snowballing. 903 called back upstairs. Now we're relocating the president of the United States because the country's under attack. And it was just a simple mission, but everybody had to go ahead and shift into the focus of protecting the president of the United States for the continuity of government. We've all been highly trained for that. We know how to do it. And but the challenge for us was normally continuity of government's a function of missiles coming into the country, sub-launch missiles, where you've got minutes to react. This had already occurred. They'd already beat us at our own game, came from in the country. So you had to step back and think about your plan, how you're going to execute to protect the president. So it was a initial attack that we all just looked at each other and just started getting inputs from each other about how we're going to solve this. And it worked perfectly. We supported the president right to the bitter end.
So how did your training experience prepare you to lead through this high pressure decisions that were required that day?
You know, everybody on the crew and much less everybody in the United States military is trained for their job, and we continually train. So what I had at Air Force One was 29 crew members, the best of the best in the United States Air Force on their job. So when everything happened, as the commander, all I had to do was tell everybody we're executing plan such and such, and everybody moved out. You know, security guys got the bigger guns and set up a perimeter. Flight attendants started prepping everything to make sure the passengers would be safe, giving them information. Radio operators established the command and control, and everything changed from a normal flight, but everybody was highly trained and highly experienced doing it. And for myself as the commander, the key to being a commander is relying on all the people around you. They're going to do their job perfectly every time. And, when you go with that mentality and everybody knows the boss is expecting the best out of them. And that's all I did day to day was let people know, you know, hey, we're the best of the best. You know, we're not going to fail the president. We're in a zero failure mission. And when you continually tell people that and thank them for what they're doing and the extra efforts, you'd be surprised how much people rally around you in time of need.
What were some of the biggest challenges you faced on 9/11 and how did you address them?
You know, the biggest challenge we started out with was we had the plane has tremendous communications. Some of it is based on civilian access to communications, civilian satellites. Due to cost saving measures, military satellites are expensive. Commercial satellites became kind of 50% of our communication. We lost all that capability within literally minutes after the second towers attacked. Airliners started sucking up the commercial satellite because their companies were letting them know, hey, lock your doors. You know, there's a great chance of being hijacked. So as we started losing all that capability, it became obvious that we needed to access military satellites around the world and steal from basically the war fighters that were not actually doing war at the point because we needed them to support the president of the United States. And eventually we came back alive, but it took us 7-8 minutes, which is critical when you're moving the president of the United States. But the key to it was the radio operators, they all came together and we had a new guy and he told us that, hey, in his previous job, highly classified, he had access to all these different military satellites. He still remembered the codes. He still remembered how to access. He came to me and said, hey, boss, can I move out and make this happen? Absolutely. You know, there's no other unit in the world has the mission that we've got at this moment. So make it happen. And that's what the beauty of the crew is. All small teams, everybody's got a tool in their toolbox when time and need to make things happen.
Looking back, is there a particular moment or memory from that day that stands out to you?
There is. You know, President Bush was, I don't think the American public knows how much information he was getting. I was on the speaker upstairs in the cockpit listening to everything he said and everything that was passed to him. And it was just constant from the vice president as well as first responders, et cetera, Rudy Giuliani, all of these leaders around the country are giving him inputs and he's making decisions. And right on the fly, he's getting all the information, he makes a decision. So when some of the news media said that the president's flying, running scared or whatever, not a chance. And the beauty is, I always joke that he's a Texan, so that there was no way in the world a Texan's running scared, all right? He wanted to be in the battle. When he had the opportunity to get hunkered down and off at Air Force Base, Nebraska, sit underground, be perfectly safe for the continuity of government, it wasn't going to happen to him. He went ahead and told us, no, we're going back to Washington, D.C. immediately. So the moment I remember is coming out of Offutt Air Force Base. I go running back up onto the plane after I've done a lot of the logistics for the aircraft to get it home. And President Bush is already there. And as I come up the stairs, he did what he always does, gives me that Texas attention getting step, drills me in the chest, and just says, Tillman, get us home now. And that's all it, that's all I'll ever remember is I jumped into the seat. We all got together. We had fighter escort bringing us home. And President Bush was downstairs making decisions. It's an amazing feeling when you know the boss, the greatest president I've flown for, is downstairs making decisions and he's got your back. That is the beauty of the commander-in-chief being right there with you.
So how many presidents have you flown for?
I started out as a co-pilot under President H.W. Bush, his father. Then I flew all 8 years of President Clinton and then was truly honored to have been selected as a numbered pilot, number 12, assigned to President George W. Bush and then commanding Air Force One. So I spent about 17 years at Air Force One.
Wow, that's amazing. What qualities or skills do you believe are the most essential for a leader in high-stakes situations like the one you encountered?
You know, this may be ego-driven, but I want, as a pilot, I wanted to make sure that I was a better pilot than everybody around me. So I studied hard, and I kept flying hard even as I got older and older as a commander. You know, some commanders work on paperwork all the time. That wasn't me. I look at it as I had an admin staff that could work on the paperwork, but I'm a flyer. I'm the president's pilot. So I flew all the time, and I flew with some amazing pilots. Honestly, we had 8 pilots. I would say that 4 of them were better pilots than I am, but they never knew that. I was basically constantly flying with them, working with them. Anything they couldn't do, I would do it and do it better. And just because I wanted them to think that, hey, the boss knows what's going on. He's right there with us. So as a leader, you know, you set the example for everybody. And when it's time to party, you party. When it's time to work hard, everybody knows to rally around. And that was the beauty of the crew. The 7 other pilots, you know, I didn't have to ask them for information. They were highly experienced and they could pass information to me immediately. So as a leader, you got to rely on the people all around you and you got to trust them. And then got to be honest, there's times when if you don't trust them, you got to face facts and look at yourself and say, hey, maybe time to move this person on because it's bringing the team down, et cetera. But as a leader, you got to make some tough calls, but you always got to have your team be the best of the best.
I think that's really great advice. And for those that are be attending your keynote at the MAP annual conference, can you give us a little preview of the themes or messages you'll be discussing?
No, definitely. I'm going to talk about zero failure missions. Some people can handle it. Some people can't. And those that can't handle the constant pressure or the responsibility, that's nothing wrong with them. You know, they're still valuable, but valuable in different in other environments. So yeah, you don't weed them out. You just make sure they know that, hey, you're going to move them on to something that's more valuable to the team. But zero failure means just that, zero failure. The other part of it is I open up with talking of a mission that we failed on. We failed President Obama, and it was all image driven. But we failed it and we took accountability for it. And that's the other key to being in high stakes environments. When you fail, you analyze what caused the failure, but you accept it immediately. You do accountability on it and you don't fend it off to somebody else because nobody else was the leader. You were the leader. Buck stops here. Now, then I'll move on to talking about September 11th, sneaking the president into Baghdad. And the whole focus is our success is not driven by me as the leader. It's driven by a group of highly trained individuals that they don't need to know they're supporting the president of the United States for the secret mission into Baghdad. All they need to know is, okay, I've been given the information. I need to execute. I need to get moving right away. And that's what I relied on that day and every day. And they just never let me down. So kind of 4 stories, talking about what the military does for you, September 11th in Baghdad, and then bring it all at the end with, I'm hoping USA, people are motivated to stand up and shout and understand that the recent election is, you know, it's not about who's leading us now. it's about everybody coming together now for a change and recognizing that, you know, the country's spoken, elected leaders in position, and whatever your desires are, just put them on the back burner, because we got to come together like everybody did during September, after September 11th, and took care of each other and took care of this country. And, you know, that was an incredible time. I know we can do it. We can do it again. You know, you're seeing sights and seeing hope that people are going to do it. And I guarantee you, people will.
I hope you're right, because there's just so much divisiveness in politics anymore. It's incredible. And I think we let the cable news networks drive the narrative, and they always like to find the most polarizing story they can find, because it sells news, right?
No, so. Definitely. Breaking news really isn't how you should lead your life. And I, you know, I joke with a lot of people that I always watch a lot of news, but I finally had to tell myself, look, you know, you're 30 minutes of news is all you need each day. And, you know, stop watching CNN and Fox and whatever. It doesn't matter which one you're watching. It's, you know, whatever they can find out bad about somebody, then it comes alive on it. And I like the idea of the nightly news, where it's 30 minutes and you learn everything you need to know in 30 minutes. And you don't leave with the constant feeling that somebody's doing bad, or somebody is actually trying to get at your family when they're really not. So it's kind of time to get away from spinning the media and spinning the facts, and let's all get together.
I think that's great. As commander of Air Force One, you have a unique perspective on working closely with high profile figures like President Bush. Do you have any memorable stories from your time in that role?
You know, I had a chance to see fly with three presidents, and but actually see amazing people on their staffs, military leaders, chiefs of staff. Andy Card is one of the greatest leaders, the chief of staff for President Bush. Mr. Card is incredible, strong Christian, just leads and motivates people constantly, and he's always there for you. So that was the biggest thing I learned with all the presidents. Every president, even though the media cuts them down all the time, they are dedicated to the American people, no matter who they are. And you watch the staff all around them trying to come up with different ways to support the American people and support America. They're always thinking outside the box to try to make things happen. And that's what I loved about the job. And you saw all the people around them, military leaders, everyone, that, you know, just tremendous people that have had tremendous backgrounds, and they've come together, and it's like a flying think tank, where they talk and they think and they make things happen, whatever's going on in the country. And, you know, in time of need, it isn't political. They really come up with answers, you know, either hurricanes or whatever it takes. You know, they take care of business. And that's the most impressive thing I've seen on Air Force One, is watching other leaders. And, you know, the final thing on that is I'm 30 feet up in the air looking out that window. And, you know, I've seen kings and queens come to the side of the aircraft, and I've seen just American people standing out there waiting to see Air Force One and the President of the United States to come off. And that's what we're about. You know, the entire middle class American people, everybody dedicated to the United States of America. It's the best feeling ever.
I can only imagine seeing that. So what's one thing, your role as commander of Air Force One, that most people might not know?
You know, it's, I guess a lot of people only think of it as, hey, you're just a pilot on the aircraft, but you're actually day to day, you're a commander in the White House. You're a commander in the United States Air Force. You're responsible for almost 300 people in your organization, but your organization is kind of the men and women in black. You don't put yourself out there because you can't do anything that will take away from the president's message of the day. So you work behind the scenes and you make everything happen. So as the commander, you're not out there trying, like some of the commanders do, to move on to the next job. Excellent chance you're in your last job, which as the commander of Air Force One, you always are. You're going to retire after the next president comes in. But some of the neat things that Air Force One does is Not only does it support the president of the United States while he's alive, after a president is passes on, you're responsible now with the Military District of Washington for the funeral of the president. So you're going to use Air Force One to go pick up the president and let him lay in state, or he or she lay in state in the Capitol, then move him back to their final resting place. So, you know, we did that for President Ford, President Nixon, you know, it was just an incredible life in it that we saw from, you know, the families of the fallen as such. So they literally, the president's families, you know, you got to know them when they're in office, then you got to know them after, you know, significant loss in their families, and everybody came together supporting them. So it's a play by play book that you open up as the president's passing, so you know what you're doing every minute as the president passes on and before the burial.
Well, I didn't realize that Air Force One was a part of that. That's very interesting. Reflecting on your career, what are you most proud of, and are there any key takeaways you'd like to share with our audience?
You know, I have three children, and I've got a son that's a fighter pilot in the Navy. I have a daughter who, you know, has been handicapped all her life, but as she's always told me, she's not handicapped, she's handicapable. And although in a wheelchair, you know, she's a guidance counselor in a high school in Florida. My youngest daughter is, you know, just an amazing individual, and, you know, works here in Scottsdale, you know, about to have her first child. It's just, the family is incredible. They, you know, I took a lot of time away from raising my kids, but every one of them is proud of what I did, and I am proud of what they've done. And the family of Air Force One, they are part of. And so even, you know, yesterday, Veterans Day, I'm getting all these texts from amazing people that did amazing things at Air Force One. And they didn't do it for me as a leader. They did it for the United States of America. And, you know, you constantly talk with them about it, and they're proud of everything they've done. I'm proud of all the things they've done. I'm proud of all the people that I've met, but mostly proud of my son and daughters and what they've accomplished in their life. And, you know, it just all comes together now that I'm retired, and, you know, now I'm the grandpa that, you know, has a grandchild that I'm creating in my own image, that he's going to be a pilot. He's going to, you know, I've given him airplanes. I've given him everything he needs and taken him flying. So, yeah, he'll be the next Air Force One commander in 22 years. So,
well, that's awesome. Hopefully that legacy continues. Lastly, any parting thoughts for those who will be attending your keynote or listening to this podcast?
Definitely. I grew up in your industry, and, you know, I saw that my dad was a civil engineer for an asphalt paving company. They had their own asphalt plant. They had their own quarry. You know, I've knocked dirt off of stakes as the roller and the, you know, the grader comes through. I put chicken inside the asphalt machine to have it cooked for my lunch with all the other workers. And the key to that industry that I learned was that taught me the basics of taking care of each other. You know, there was always a big rivalry between those that were, you know, building the roads and those that were laying the asphalt. And, you know, it was always a big joke that the guys that built the road didn't build it as good as they could have, and the asphalt guys had to recover from it and make things happen for them. And then it was a constant fight between them. But in the end, everybody came together at the end of the day, laughing, having a beer and whatever. And that was what I always learned from my father. And you know, and I still remember to this day, my mom taking his clothes. He had to take his clothes off outside because he had asphalt on him. He had to hang them up outside, and he had like six pair of pants. And she would try her best to get the asphalt on him, but he constantly smelled like asphalt. So you knew he was coming. And those are the memories of your industry and everything that's going on. And I'm going to be truly honored to come talk with you all.
I think it's really neat that you have a connection to the industry. I mean, I feel like they're all siblings. They all like to fight, but at the end of the day, they all got each other's backs. And it's really a neat industry to work in. So looking forward.
I've seen it. I'm definitely looking forward to talking with you all.
Well, I'd like to thank you for listening to Asphalt Talk, the podcast by and for asphalt professionals. If you enjoyed listening and learned something, Please leave us a review. Your review will help us connect with other professionals like yourself so we can keep this conversation going.
1992 called, they want their website back. Stop apologizing for your crappy site and stop working with that company who thinks Hot Mix is the latest snack craze. Work with folks who have been speaking your language for the past 17 years. And get a website that's not a gigantic pain in the you-know-what to build. Visit maycreate.com, that's M-A-Y-E-create.com, for a free consultation and quote. Because if you think your website sucks, so does everyone else.